their leader returns for a long-awaited reunion. But the face of a sworn enemy...
What's she doing here?
...is never a welcome one.
I want to know everything.
If I told you everything, you'd kill me.
What do you think I'll do if you don't?
All New Lost, Wednesday at 10, 9 Central, only on ABC.
You know, there are a lot of people waiting for that tonight. They're waiting for that all-new episode of Lost. It has a pretty remarkable television viewership. It's a pop culture phenomenon. We're going to be talking about this ABC television program called Lost and what insights there might be in this pop culture phenomenon, especially for the Christian trying to engage the culture that we are called to address with the gospel. Robert Velarde is our guest in the first half hour or so of Issues, Etc. We're going to spend the second half hour with Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute. There is a study, you might have heard about it on the news, in the Journal of the American Medical Association on the effectiveness of adult, I repeat, adult stem cells in the treating of type 1 diabetes, which is apparently of epidemic proportions. So, let's see what Wesley has to say about that coming up here in about 25 minutes on the program. From just before the top of the hour, we're going to be doing some audio open lines. We've got an NPR story on the stem cell debate in the U.S. Senate. Of course, that's following up on our conversation with Wesley Smith. We'll be talking then at the 4 o'clock hour with Bob Lico about, well, first of all, you've heard about him before. De Jesus Miranda, he believes he is Jesus. And a better Jesus than the Jesus of Nazareth. We'll also talk with Bob Lico about the Jesus Tomb documentary briefly. Then, that'll run, about a half hour. Then we'll be talking with Dr. R. Scott Clark on the purpose of the Bible. Dr. Clark says the Bible is about something. It's not just a random collection of moral stories and life lessons. We'll round off today's program with some more audio open lines. We're going to be talking about a pastor who's developed, you've heard about the WWJD bracelet. It was so popular. You wore one, I'm sure you did, maybe even a baseball cap with that embroidered on it. Well, this pastor has a new idea. No complaints. That's his bracelet. No complaints. He wants a complaint-free world. And the world would be a better place if we all stopped complaining. We'll talk with you about that during audio open lines, and we'll hear a little story in the news about that pastor and his complaint-free bracelet coming up at the end of the program today. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can email us here for the next 3 hours in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Robert Velarde is a regular guest. He's pursuing graduate studies in philosophy at Denver Seminary. He's author of several books, including a forthcoming publication titled Talking Sense with C.S. Lewis, and he's also written an article in the latest Christian research journal called The Gospel According to Lost. Robert, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
It's always great to be on your program, Todd. I appreciate your way you approach these topics. It looks like you got a great show lined up today.
Thank you very much. Well, starting out with this subject, pop culture, it kind of in its quintessence, Lost, as something that many people are tuning in on Wednesday nights to see, anxiously awaiting this. Christians might say, look, this is just pop culture. We don't even need to worry about this, watch it, or be concerned about anything it has to say. Your response?
Well, I get into that a bit in my article. I have a whole section in there called Apologetics in the Age of Show Business, and I kind of look at some different approaches. You know, there's sort of a Christian approach that says, well, you know, don't bother with television. It's not really even worth watching. In general, it's just an image-driven entertainment thing. We can't really get much out of it. On the other hand, we, I think, have a biblical mandate to engage the culture. That might be more of a, say, a Francis Schaeffer approach. You know, I think it's good to have an awareness of television and what's happening in it. It really is a major influence. Some would call it an idol in our culture. But I think that very fact means that it requires our attention. It's something that we should be looking at as apologists, as theologians, as philosophers, as just general Christian laymen and thinkers. To see, well, what is it about a particular program, in this case Lost, that we can gain from it, that we can use in our efforts to evangelize?
For those of us who have only seen the trailers of Lost episodes and not a full episode at all, or watched seasons of it now in its third season, give us the general storyline of the program.
Sure. This show began in September 2004, and the initial plot line is fairly simple. There's a crash of an airline, a commercial airliner, on a deserted island, at least the passengers think it's deserted, somewhere in the South Pacific. And you have a group of very diverse people, which is one of the things that makes the show interesting. There's a cast of more than a dozen primary characters, and these people have to learn how to get along on this island, where they find out eventually that they're 1,000 miles off course and nobody knows where they are. And the program is about how they grapple not only with each other in dealing with this situation, but each episode features a flashback where the characters will remember, you know, one character in particular each episode will remember something from their past that relates to their current situation. And a lot of those themes and a lot of those flashbacks really have to do with these characters kind of grappling with their guilt and their desire for some kind of redemption or coming to terms with what they lived like before they were just on this island.
So where, at what points, and let's try and deal with them one at a time, at what points can a Christian who is approaching, as you advise, this pop culture phenomenon, both critically and intelligently, and with an eye toward engaging the culture and its prevailing ideas, at what points will Christians find something to mine from the message of loss?
Well, I think what is unique about Lost, and it's certainly not the only program where one can glean some Christian messages from it, or at least ideas that would relate to the Christian message, I think what is unique is that Lost does it fairly consistently. There are several different areas that I address in my article that touch upon this. And as far as, you know, the whole approach to popular culture from a Christian perspective, I sort of summarized T.M. Moore's approach in his book Redeeming Pop Culture. It was published a few years back by P&R Publishing, and I do list six of his points there in the article as to how he advises Christians to deal with pop culture. The first thing I deal with, though, in the article in relation to Lost is how it discusses the concepts of faith and reason, and in some ways it also applies them to this sort of dichotomy that we get in our culture between science and religion. That they can't be joined together. A law sort of communicates this fact that there's a separation between faith and reason.
And is it does it challenge the prevailing notion at all in the program that faith and reason are of two entirely different realms and never the twain meet?
It doesn't in general. What it does is it contrasts two of the main characters, a guy named Jack, who's a medical doctor, obviously has the scientific background, and there's another character named Locke. Interestingly enough, he's named John Locke. Some of the characters are sort of hint at philosophical figures. And John Locke tends to be more mystical, more faith-based, and they really are at odds, these characters, at times because of their different approaches. And, you know, Lost really doesn't try to reconcile that other than to show, well, here's a man of faith and here's a man of science. And, you know, what I try to address in the article is, you know, hey, these two guys could probably get along a whole lot better if they really had a better understanding of the concepts of faith and reason and how they actually work together in Christianity. You know, Christianity is not based on blind faith, or our faith should not be based on blind faith. It should be faith founded on fact, as John Montgomery said years ago in the title of a book, faith that works with reason for us to believe. That's not to minimize the value of faith. But it's wrong to say that Christians believe only because of faith or faith that is not founded on anything.
So is Lost's characterization through these two figures, both Locke and Jack, is it a fair representation of the position of faith and a fair representation of the position of reason, or does it help us more diagnose the culture's misperception of those two things?
Well, I think it is a mirror of what popular culture and what people in general in our country think of the situation between faith and reason. We think that they need to be separated. We've kind of bought into this whole separation of church and state mentality, this concept that, well, you know, what you do on Sundays at church is, you know, your faith, and the rest of the week or whatever, you know, you're into the reason aspect of your life. We tend to divide them. And really, you know, thinkers going back to Augustine and later developed by Aquinas said, no, you know, faith and reason need to work together. And I think the program in relationship to faith leans a little bit too far in the direction of what we might call fideism. You know, this faith that is just founded on nothing, really. It's sort of a leap of faith, almost a Kierkegaardian sort of approach to faith, as opposed to a thinking faith by some of the great thinkers of the Christian Church, such as Augustine. In that respect, Locke, you know, is more a proponent of blind faith, really. He doesn't seem to have a whole lot of a place where he grounds his faith. Whereas science, on the other hand, represented by Jack, I think it's a pretty fair representation of what we have in culture at large. You have the naturalists, of course, who say, you know, the physical world is all that exists. There's nothing beyond it. And hence you end up having this struggle between the sort of neo-Darwinian evolutionists and everyone else, you know, including intelligent design proponents that say, no, there might be something more to this, that tend to be shut down by the media, that tends to favor the naturalistic perspective.
All right. Another feature of the program Lost that you say Christians ought to take note of is its mystical element. Describe that for us.
Sure. Yeah, I actually grapple with mysticism, fate, and chance in the program. They're sort of intertwined there in the way that Lost presents them. You know, again, we're kind of back to this character Locke, who's sort of a mystic of sorts. He's has this interesting background in having been involved in a variety of things. He had wanted to go on a walkabout in Australia, which is how he ended up on the plane that crashed in the South Pacific. You know, this spiritual journey. He's searching for something. He comes to believe on this island in a sort of animism, in a mystical sense, that the island is alive in some way spiritually, that he can commune with it, that it can give him messages and things like that. And then there's a big emphasis on fate. Locke is a big proponent of that aspect, that things are destined to happen. There are some other characters that provide a contrast to that say, well, no, everything is just chance. And, of course, again, you're dealing with sort of the naturalistic worldview. In a world, a universe that is just the product of random chance and a lot of time, there really is no purpose or direction to anything. On the other hand, we don't want to go so far as to be fatalistic and say that everything that happens, there's nothing we can do about it. I think the solution there that I bring in is God's providence. How is it that God works in the world? Well, he directs history with a purpose. You know, God is sovereign. God is in control of these things. You know, providence, I quote in the article a passage from Evangelical Dictionary Theology, where one writer says, providence is God's gracious outworking of his purpose in Christ, which issues in his dealings with man. He goes on to say that our lives are not ruled by chance or by fate, but by God, who lays bare his purposes of providence in the incarnation of his Son.
You know, the interesting thing about that quote, and that really stuck out to me, was that contrary to a kind of the American view of providence, the generic American view of providence, where, yeah, there is a God, probably a generic God, someplace out there who set things into motion and in some way directs the course of human affairs, directly or indirectly. The Christian view of providence is entirely, as you have said, Christ-centered. Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. I think that is a very important point. And that quote I think I had from that dictionary was from Thomas Parker, who wrote that entry in that dictionary. Christ is really at the center of this whole issue of providence, you know, in his dealings with humanity. And I get into the sort of the Christocentric perspective later in the article as well when I talk about redemption, which we can get to. But I think having this Christ-centered approach to providence gives a new twist, I guess, not so much a twist, but some new insights onto what providence is. You know, as you said, there tends to be in American culture this misunderstanding or this different approach to providence. We almost see it as this impersonal thing, like a force or energy that's directing things. You know, we, even as evangelicals, I think, are losing sight of the fact that Christ is at the center of our theology and that God is a personal, transcendent being who actually cares about what's happening in our world.
We're talking with Robert Velarde, who is pursuing graduate studies in philosophy at Denver Seminary, author of several books, including a forthcoming publication titled Talking Sense with C.S. Lewis, and author of an article in the latest Christian Research Journal called The Gospel According to Lost, about this ABC television program and pop culture phenomenon, Lost. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. What type of ethical systems are on display in the television program Lost?
That's a great question. And, you know, I don't watch a whole lot of television, which is interesting because I've written an article, of course, on Lost. I watch Lost. I watch 24. You know, I watch about 2 to 4 hours of television a week. So I'm not exactly the connoisseur of television here, you know, with average American watching several hours per day, I believe, is the latest statistic. But the ethical aspects, I think, are very interesting. Sort of, again, mirrors our culture and what people think about right and wrong and good and evil. And you're going to talk about stem cell debate later. One of the things that Lost gets into is this philosophical ethical system called utilitarianism. And I think you get that in the stem cell debate. Utilitarianism basically says that, well, we need to do what's best for the greatest number of people. And a lot of times you get that debate in the stem cell issue. It's like, well, you know, if we can get some stem cells off X number of babies or fetuses, you know, they're going to benefit a lot of people in the long term. But who are we to say what is right or what is wrong? And it sort of overlooks the whole question of, well, are you dealing with a human life or not? And that's really utilitarianism, that you're trying to do the greatest good for the greatest number. And you get that in Lost in several aspects. You know, one of them is this sort of torture perspective where they feel the only option they have is to torture somebody to get the greatest good as a result. Another aspect ethically that they have in the program is what's referred to as ethical egoism. One character in particular named Sawyer in the show demonstrating really what ethical egoism is all about, a real self-centered approach that appeals to our culture, really, but it also has its problems. You know, how do you settle ethical conflicts in a system where if you have an ego that's opposed to your ethical egoism, you really end up with a sort of ethical anarchy.
But, you know, in this way, I think Lost probably best captures what most Americans would consider their only two alternatives as
sure.
far as an ethical system goes.
Yeah, and if you really dig into this a bit, you know, if you want a good introduction to this, read a chapter in Scott Ray's book, Moral Choices, where he lays out several of the options, you know, including ethical egoism and utilitarianism, moral relativism. You know, I really have to give Lost some credit in this regard. They do not seem to be proponents of moral relativism. Because they have sort of this foundation in a lot of their characters that they have done something wrong, and they know it, and they need to deal with that. So it doesn't promote moral relativism, but neither does it promote what we'd call Christian ethics, which could be sort of a combination of some of these different ethical theories. You know, Christianity sort of has this divine command, or we'd say philosophically, this deontological aspect that's based in God as giving the commands. You know, we have the Ten Commandments. But we also have this component of virtue, virtue ethics in Christian ethics, building our characters. You know, Christ talked so much about that sort of approach, you know, saying it's not just your external actions, it is your internal thoughts and behaviors that are also important in building your character.
I think you mentioned Dr. John Warwick Montgomery before, and he has often talked on these airwaves about how every good story, good myth, good true story, in fact, has a redemptive arc. Is the same true of Lost?
That seems to be the case. There is that theme of redemption, and that is the fourth aspect of the program I discuss in my article in the Christian Research Journal. You know, that we have this, obviously, the biblical aspect, you know, Ephesians 1:7, in Christ we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins in accordance with the riches of God's grace. What's interesting in the way Lost approaches this redemption, however, is that it's really more of a self-redemption rather than a Christ-centered redemption. These characters are trying to struggle on their own to grapple with some of these horrible things they've done. You have some characters who have been torturers, who have murdered, who have been professional con men, and they are trying to resolve these problems on their own steam. You have Locke, of course, trying to grapple with this animistic view of the island. But really that contrasts significantly with the Christian approach. You know, Christianity is not this bootstrap religion where we have to do this or we have to do that. In fact, Christianity teaches that there is nothing that we can do to reconcile ourselves with God. God takes the initiative. God reaches out to us, and we must bow down to him on our knees and look to his grace for salvation.
So in the end, coming back to a proper Christian engagement of pop culture with Lost in mind as a specific, what is the most important aspect of how a viewer, in this case a Christian, how should they look at this pop culture phenomenon Lost, with about a minute here to respond and no more?
Well, I think we need to look at it redemptively, which is one of T.M. Moore's points. What is it that we can do to redeem pop culture? What aspects of it can we take away and incorporate into an overall apologetic approach or an evangelistic approach? How can we latch on to some of these ideas? And I think we need to have a dialogue-based approach. We need to interact not only with people who watch pop culture, which is just about everybody in our society, but those who create it. How can we dialogue with them? How can we as Christians be involved in popular culture, and can we redeem it in some way for the glory of God?
Robert Velarde is pursuing graduate studies in philosophy at Denver Seminary. He's author of several books, including a forthcoming publication called Talking Sense with C.S. Lewis. He's written an article for the latest Christian research journal called The Gospel According to Lost. Robert, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
We have so much around us. We are inundated with images on television. It is overwhelming. The Christian can choose to cut themselves off from it entirely. And I understand why someone might do this, because with the sheer momentum and the sheer magnitude of these images, a Christian might feel completely overwhelmed. But we don't get to choose the world that we live in. We do not get to choose the world to which we are called with the gospel, the saving message of Jesus Christ crucified and risen for sinners. We do not have the luxury of saying, well, when the world comes around to my way of thinking, then I'll start to get engaged with what the world is doing. We do not have that luxury. Christians, for all of their history, have sooner or later realized that they are called to the world where God has put them, that time, that place, those ideas. Now, what is the challenge? Many have said, and many say nowadays, that the challenge is to accommodate. That's wrong. The church's challenge is not to accommodate the culture, but to engage, to understand, and in most cases, not to agree. It is not a Christian witness simply to say, well, that's wrong, and that's wrong, and that's wrong in the culture. No, we need to understand what the culture is saying, and then respond with the truth of God's word. With the truth of God's word that is centered entirely upon the saving work of Jesus Christ, who did not deign it unfit for him to enter our world when he did where he did for you and for me, to give his life as a ransom for us sinners. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to visit with the author of the new book, The Faith of Condoleezza Rice. And when we come back from this break, we're going to spend a few minutes with Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute. There's a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association on the effectiveness of adult stem cells in treating type 1 diabetes. We'll hear about that and talk with Wesley after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
There's no shortage of marriage books on the Christian bookshelves. The problem is, many of them provide nothing more than moral principles for improving your marriage. In this way, these Christian books on marriage are little better than the secular books on marriage. Marriage is Like Dancing is the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April. And this marriage book is different. This marriage book is Christ-centered, cross-focused. You can find Marriage is Like Dancing at either of Concordia Publishing House's two locations in the St. Louis area, 3558 South Jefferson in the city, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. The book is called Marriage is Like Dancing. It's our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April. Those two addresses, 3558 South Jefferson in the city, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. Look for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for April. Marriage is Like Dancing.
Another Asian nation is experiencing the consequences of abortion. This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Vietnam is experiencing the same problem as other Asian nations, such as China, North Korea, and India, where boys are preferred and girls fall victim to abortions. Though the Vietnamese government has heavily subsidized abortion for years, it has recently begun issuing fines to those who have abortions for sex selection reasons. It also held a national symposium in December to educate residents about the problem. In addition to being a human rights violation, gender imbalance fuels human trafficking and increases social instability as a growing population of men search for partners.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I don't have a transcript of the quotation, but I heard it clearly Sunday night on ESPN News. Zach Johnson, 31 years old, had just won a surprise victory at the Masters Golf Tournament. After last year's champion Phil Mickelson helped him put on the honored green sports coat, Mr. Johnson thanked many people. At the end of his list of thanks, he noted that he had won the Masters on Easter Sunday, and he thanked Jesus. No surprise that didn't show up in our local newspaper. Public newspapers carry secular news, so religious stories usually get relegated to a Friday or Saturday human interest column. I understand that. But I also know that public references to Jesus get politically correct types Twitter-pated, especially if the confession comes from someone who is successful. Jesus people, their stereotype goes, are simple-minded bumpkins. Okay, just don't try to impose your Jesus beliefs and morality on us. Call 911. So what palpitations come when someone who is successful in the world, like Zach Johnson, mentions Jesus? That leads me to this conclusion. Won't the church's witness to our Savior be more compelling if we try to be the very best at our worldly jobs? Saved by grace does not mean that Jesus is an excuse for sloth in his followers.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Here in the second half hour of the program, Wesley Smith has been kind enough to join us on short notice. We came across this ABC News story on treating type 1 diabetes, which is a huge problem, with adult stem cells. We're going to hear a very brief play of that package from ABC News, and then Wesley Smith is going to join us to discuss it. I'm sure he has something to say. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. You can email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Before we welcome Wesley Smith, let's hear this story from ABC News on adult stem cells and type 1 diabetes.
Today, doctors report on a treatment that uses stem cells to free some patients with type 1 diabetes from insulin for long periods of time. In a small Brazilian study, doctors first harvested stem cells from 15 patients' own blood. These stem cells in the blood have moderate flexibility in their identities. They are not as malleable as the controversial embryonic stem cells, but they are not as fixed as other forms of stem cells. Next, the patients received high doses of chemotherapy to suppress their immune systems. In type 1 diabetes, the immune system malfunctions and attacks cells that produce insulin. By suppressing the immune system, doctors stop the attack and allow the cells to create insulin again. After the chemotherapy, the patients all received an injection of their own stem cells to essentially reboot their immune systems. The treatment allowed most patients in this small study to be free from insulin for weeks, some for many months at a time. Doctors say this sort of stem cell-based therapy may one day be used to treat other immune system disorders such as rheumatoid arthritis and multiple sclerosis. With this Medical Minute, I'm Dr. Timothy Johnson.
Wesley Smith joins us. He's a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, a special consultant for the Center for Bioethics and Culture, and he's author of several books, including Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. He's a regular guest. Wesley, welcome back.
Hey, Todd, did you notice how they had to try to still boost embryonic stem cells in that piece?
All right, take that apart for us, because I had a suspicion that might be one of your concerns about the way, not what happened and not what was being reported, but the way in which it was reported.
Well, you know, if this breakthrough, human patients, and by the way, some have been without insulin for years, not just months. If human patients had been treated successfully for any condition with an embryonic stem cell therapy, the headlines would be so big you could hear them across the world. The news media would have stopped normal programming in order to permit this story to go forward. Now we have human diabetes patients successfully treated. We don't yet know for sure if it's a full and permanent cure, but certainly successfully treated. And yes, it's being reported. How could they not? But it's being reported very mutely, and they cannot resist saying, well, these are not as valuable as embryonic stem cells, as plastic and as malleable. Well, these adult stem cells don't cause tumors. Embryonic stem cells, when they've been tried to treat animals of Parkinson's and diabetes and other kinds of afflictions, cause tumors. So the idea that somehow embryonic are superior, which was still they're still desperately trying to prop up after adult success, after adult success, after umbilical cord blood stem cell success, after another success, still trying to prop up this shaky idea of embryonic stem cells being superior is really pretty ridiculous.
The definite impression is left to the person who's listening carefully, or perhaps not listening carefully enough. Just think how much more success we could have had they used the pluripotent and apparently miraculous embryonic stem cell.
Exactly, and that if Bush hadn't been such a horrible religious fanatic, why, we'd have even better cures because they'd be embryonic, which, of course, is silly.
Okay, then let's deal with, I think, probably the all-too-common notion that stem cells is stem cells.
Well, stem cells, they have different varieties and they come from different places. Realize that the controversy that we've had has not been a science debate, it's been an ethics debate. Embryonic stem cells are controversial because to obtain them, you have to, at least at this time, destroy embryos. Moreover, they are the gateway to human cloning because if you use embryonic stem cells from IVF babies, assuming they can ever be used safely in humans, which so far they cannot be used safely in humans, you'd still have a tissue rejection issue, which the scientists are saying, well, then we'll do human cloning, which they haven't been able to do yet. It may take 10 or 20 years to perfect, if it can be perfected at all. And even then, that wouldn't solve the tumor issue. So you've got that kind of problem in terms of ethics, plus the issue, as we've discussed on your show, that to do human cloning, you need an egg per attempt. And this leads to the potential exploitation of poor women for their eggs. Since you're not going to get enough eggs through normal donation procedures, you try to you pay poor women to go through superovulation, which could cost them their lives even. That's the issue over, that's in a nutshell, the controversy over embryonic stem cells and human cloning. Adult stem cells are different than embryonic stem cells in that they may not be able to be transformed into every tissue in the body. But that isn't the point. The point is that they are able to go forward without causing tumors so far. And we've seen, we've just now seen effective treatments for diabetes. We've seen human patients restore feeling. Paralyzed patients with stem cell injury have feeling restored in their bodies using their own olfactory adult stem cells, that is nasal stem cells. We've had multiple sclerosis stopped in its tracks, not cured, but stopped from getting worse, using bone marrow stem cells. We've got success after success, stem cells being used to treat heart disease after success, and yet we still hear, oh, it's just got to be the embryonic. Well, here's an interesting quote from the AP story that ran on this diabetes piece. This research was done in Brazil, and it was done under the auspices of an American doctor named Richard K. Burt of Northwestern. And here's what he said, quote, "The research was done in Brazil because doctors in the United States were not interested in the approach." Now, Todd, why might that be? Why might doctors not be interested in pursuing this approach, which apparently works? Perhaps it's because all of the money is now being pushed toward embryonic stem cells and all of the sexiness, if you will, and all of the prestige, even though it may not work. So we can see that the propaganda that has been promoted since Bush instituted his funding policy in 2001, the embryonic propaganda, may also be distorting the proper approach to science.
Well, that leads us, of course, to what's being discussed, perhaps, if I'm not up on my facts, even coming to a conclusion in some sense in the U.S. Senate as we speak, Wesley, and that's an attempt, another attempt on the part of the House and the Senate to essentially overturn what the president put in August 2001, limiting federal funding for embryonic stem cell lines from in vitro fertilization embryos.
That will be passed because the facts don't matter in this debate. What matters is the hype. What matters is the propaganda. And what matters is the perception that among many people suffering from very terrible diseases, that their only hope is embryonic stem cell research, because that's what they keep getting told by the scientists and by the media in this astonishing propaganda campaign. Bush will again veto the bill as he did last time. And interestingly, the reason why there's such hatred at President Bush's policy is because by strong implication, by refusing to permit taxpayer money to be used to destroy embryos for research, because that's all we're talking about, the federal government put $50 million out last year for human embryonic stem cell research, Todd. $50 million. Between 2001 and 2007, projected, the federal government, the feds, will have put out $171 million, or maybe it's $161 million, for human embryonic stem cell research using the lines that George Bush said were acceptable, that is, lines already in existence. When you add in the animal embryonic stem cell research funded by the federal government, the number comes to approximately $650 million. So we're not talking about no money for embryonic stem cell research. We're not even necessarily talking about less money than would have otherwise been given, because there was no money limit. There just weren't enough applications for there to be increased funding over what was given. So what we're really talking about here is an assault on the implication of the policy. That is, that it is unethical and immoral to destroy human life, even nascent human life, as if it were a mere corn crop ripe for the harvest. That is what the embryonic stem cell researchers, what the science establishment, and what many in Congress for other reasons cannot abide. President Bush is saying human life has intrinsic value simply and merely because it is human, and that is what must be destroyed. I mean, otherwise, talking over, let's say, 10 or 20 million, if it would be that, and some inconvenience in terms of setting up labs, should not have created this great hue and cry. What it is the science community has actually been told, you know, there are some things that are just not right, at least to do with federal money, and that's what cannot be abided. And that's what this huge fight has really been all about. And yet, take a look at what's happened because of President Bush's position. Germany followed his position almost to the T. Because the embryo still matters, we are not funding human cloning research, which we would be by now without Bush's policy. Moreover, we are trying to find ways to create pluripotent stem cells, that is, those kinds of stem cells that can be, in theory, because it hasn't been done, transformed into every type of human cell without destroying embryos. There's another bill, S-30, that would fund things such as tissue, where you take a skin cell and you revert it, skin cell, and revert it back to the embryonic state, which has been done successfully in mice. The altered nuclear transfer proposal, the idea of identifying embryos that are actually dead so that when you take the stem cells from them, it would be akin to taking an organ from a cadaver. These things can be funded. They're pro-science. They've proved successful so far in early research. They are not controversial, and yet you'll find many will not vote for this bill, and yet they're not called anti-science. Why? because the issue is getting access to treating nascent human life as a thing, as an object. And until that is accomplished, these advocates are not going to rest. Yet President Bush's policy has promoted very good science, things that might not otherwise have been explored, but for his very strong and principled statement that this is not something you should do to any human life, treat it as a corn crop to be harvested.
Let's go to Florida and talk with Matt, who's waiting on the line. Thanks for being patient, Matt. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon, guys.
Hey,
I'm always patient. You guys have got great things to say here. I think that the reason that scientists, at least in America, don't want anything to do with this is because of one word, and it's consumerism. And this is everybody's line of thinking most of the time. It's like this. If you had fun driving a Mustang, wait till you drive a Jaguar.
That's
if you think your cold went away quickly with generic stuff, whether you tried the name brands. If you thought this $1,000 TV looks good, wait till you see the $2,000 one. If you think adult stem cells are good, wait till you see what embryonic stem cells can do.
Right.
That's a very interesting point, and that's an interesting sociological point, and there may be some truth in that. Because a lot, and there is, by the way, plenty of adult stem cell research happening in the United States. And most of it is privately funded, although the feds certainly do give plenty of money for it. But it just isn't getting the kind of spectacular attention that a mouse success would with embryonic stem cells. And you may have hit the point. It's because this is glitzier to do it with the embryos as opposed to plodding along with adult stem cells, which may be effective but isn't exciting and sexy. That's a very good point, Matt.
In what sense, and I hear you saying this again and again, Wesley, in what sense is embryonic stem cell research this threshold issue past which we enter perhaps a point of no return on and into a brave new world, treating, as you said, treating nascent human life as a thing?
Well, once you've made that statement in principle that we can, and when the law says we'll fund it, then you've really created a very strong principle that this is right. Once you have created the principle in law, in public policy, that nascent human life can be used as a thing, then what in the world would make us leave it with early embryos and petri dishes? There is nothing in about the early embryo in the petri dish that the same arguments could not be applied to embryos at 8 weeks old, if you could gestate them, say, in an artificial womb, which should be online in about 10 years, or even fetuses 6 months old, 8 months old. In fact, as we've talked about, New Jersey has legalized human cloning, allows implantation of the cloned embryo into a womb, and gestation through the ninth month. That's fetal farming. It cannot be done yet technologically, but the law is already on the books in New Jersey, which would permit that to be done. And human cloning, which is where this leads, is the key to genetic engineering, human enhancement, that whole transhumanism issue we talked about trying to transform humans into a post-human species, organ farming, that is growing fetuses for their kidneys, and things of that sort, doing live fetal experiments on cloned embryos to see how certain things occur. We've already done live fetal experiments back in the late 60s and early 70s for those who think we might not do it. At that time, it was stopped because when it became public, there was an outcry. Because at that time, and that outcry, by the way, was led by Ted Kennedy. Because at that time, there was still the concept that human life had intrinsic value simply because it was human, that the sanctity of human life ethic precluded us from treating fetuses as guinea pigs. I wonder, Todd, if today we could do live fetal experiments and somebody, scientists could say, but this will cure your Uncle Charlie's Parkinson's, if most people in this country would say, well, they're never going to be born anyway. Let's let it go. Let's do it. I'm afraid that there would be many people in this country, if not a majority, many, who would say, well, so what? We can abort fetuses, so why not experiment on them?
Two final things, Wesley. You spoke a moment ago positively about President Bush's stance on the issue of stem cell research. People really ought to know that you're not some Republican Party spokesperson.
Well, I stay out of partisan politics. I guess you're getting at the fact that I once co-authored books with Ralph Nader. Those and Ralph's a very good friend of mine. Those issues were nothing compared to what I'm doing now. I mean, those were different issues.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not get engaged in partisan politics. I consider myself a Martin Luther King liberal. That is, I believe in the intrinsic equality of human life. Today, that is deemed conservative, but to me, it's Martin Luther King liberalism, which tells you what's happened to the left, in my view.
Then bottom line, then finally, ethically, what is wrong with embryonic stem cell research?
Nothing. Oh, embryonic stem cell. I thought you said stem cell research. embryonic stem cell research is unethical because it takes human life and it treats it as an object instead of a subject, because it opens the door to human cloning, and because it tells us as a society that when human life is at its most vulnerable, it can be used instrumentally as a thing to benefit the rest of us, which undermines the very concept of the sanctity and importance of human life.
You can stay informed on issues bioethical by going to Wesley Smith's website. It's www.wesleyjsmith.com, wesleyjsmith.com. Wesley is a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, a special consultant for the Center on Bioethics and Culture, and author of several books. His latest is A Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. Wesley, thank you again for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd. Always good speaking with you.
Well, following up on this conversation with Wesley, this comes from National Public Radio. It's the latest on the Senate debate over a stem cell bill that would broaden federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. The president is expected to veto it, and it's basically trying to overturn what the president did in August 2001, limiting federal funding for embryonic stem cell research in the lines of cells.
This report may start out sounding like you've heard it before. The Senate is expected to pass legislation on stem cell research today. It would expand the number of embryonic stem cell lines eligible for federal research money. It's almost the same bill that passed last year. And just like last year, President Bush is expected to veto it if it reaches his desk. Now here's what might be different. Democrats hope they might have the votes to override that veto, as NPR's David Wellner reports.
This time there are several newly elected Democrats backing this cause who replaced Republicans who'd opposed it. What's more, National Institutes of Health Director Elias Zerhouni last month broke with the White House on stem cells. He told a Senate panel the nation would be better served if American scientists were given access to more embryonic stem cell lines than the couple of dozen that President Bush sanctioned nearly 6 years ago. Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin is the chief sponsor of the bill expanding such access, and he urged his colleagues to heed the NIH director's advice.
Now, Dr. Zerhouni is the federal government's top scientist in the area of medical research. President Bush appointed him to be the director of the National Institutes of Health. So it took great courage on his part to say in public that we need to change direction on stem cell research. But he did so because it's the truth.
There's broad public support for more stem cell research since it holds the promise of curing everything from Alzheimer's disease to juvenile diabetes. So a vote against Harkin's bill could hurt senators facing tough re-election bids next year. One such senator is Minnesota Republican Norm Coleman. He's co-sponsoring a competing stem cell bill that senators leery about using human embryos can vote for later today. It too calls for more stem cell research as long as it does not involve viable human embryos.
Some would say it's not all we want, but we're moving the science forward. Let's do that. Hopefully real hope will be given and real cures ultimately will be found. And we'll have done it in a way that doesn't kind of engage the culture wars, but in the end makes real progress with real science.
Both stem cell bills are expected to easily pass with more than 60 votes. The big question is whether there's the two-thirds majority needed to override a presidential veto of the bill supporting more embryonic stem cell research. California Democrat Dianne Feinstein called on groups backing it to pressure lawmakers.
We're very close to making a veto-proof bill, but it's really up to you. It's really up to your now coming forward and rallying people to call members in the Senate that might be turned around by the specific nature of this bill, the fact that it has passed the House once, the fact that we have something which is essentially as big a compromise as we can possibly make.
That compromise involved adding language supporting other kinds of stem cell research as well. Still, Utah Republican Orrin Hatch, who backs the bill, says it did not help that Democrats made stem cell research a campaign issue last year.
I tried to talk my colleagues into not making it political in the last election. I think that cost us. I think we would have probably 70 votes today if it hadn't been made political in the last election.
But bill sponsor Harkin says that election had a big lesson for lawmakers, namely that if they oppose expanding access to embryonic stem cells, they do so at their peril.
As you look across the landscape, it was clear that the people voted last November for candidates that supported embryonic stem cell research on both sides of the aisle, I might add. It wasn't necessarily one party or the other.
Democrats concede, though, that while they may be within one vote of a veto-proof bill in the Senate, getting a similar two-thirds majority in the House will be much harder. And that's what it would take to override the presidential veto threatened again yesterday by the White House. David Wellna, NPR News, the Capitol.
Here's a bit of a timeline. The first embryonic stem cells were isolated in mice in 1981. It wasn't until 1998 that researchers managed to derive stem cells from human embryos.
All right, there's the story from National Public Radio. And, of course, it is expected to pass the Senate, and the president is expected to veto it. It took a long time for this president to get his veto pin out, but he started using it on these issues. And one thing is for sure, whether you were fully in favor of the president's decision in August to compromise on federal funding for embryonic stem cell research, he seems to be willing at this point to hold the line on that he drew back in August of 2001. And that's good news. Today is the final day to register for the LCMS Conference on Mercy. It's April the 30th through May the 2nd, right here in St. Louis at the St. Louis Airport Marriott. This conference features some regular guests from Issues, etc., and we will be broadcasting live from the conference. It's April the 30th through May the 2nd, and today is the last day to register. Here's how you can register. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Right there on the homepage, you're going to find the logo for the LCMS Conference on Mercy. It's a heart-shaped logo. You'll find a link there to the conference information and a way to register online. Issuesetc.org is our homepage. It's the LCMS Conference on Mercy, April the 30th through May the 2nd, right here in St. Louis at the St. Louis Airport Marriott. We'll be there broadcasting live. We're looking forward to seeing you there as well. When we come back from this break, Bob Lico joins us. We'll spend a half hour with him talking about two issues. One, this guy, he lives out in Miami, I believe. He's got a church that is very rapidly growing. He has an interesting message. It's unique in many ways. He says he's the reincarnation, the second coming of Jesus. In fact, he says he's even greater than Jesus of Nazareth. And he's here to bring the kingdom of God on earth. De Jesus Miranda is his name. We'll also talk about the Jesus Tomb documentary with Bob Lico of Discernment Ministry International. We'll spend a few minutes after that talking with Dr. R. Scott Clark about the purpose of the Bible. And then we'll have audio open lines for the remainder of the program in the third hour. A Fox and Friends interview with a pastor who's got a no complaints bracelet. He wants you to wear it and he wants you to stop complaining. And the world, he says, would be a better place. An NBC story on sex offenders in church. Big question for you there is, if there was a registered sex offender who wanted to join your church, what would you do? We'll be right back. Talk with Bob Lico.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.